This is a podcast from thebuglepodcast.com.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to instalment 4 of our summer sabbatical specials. I'm Andy Zoltzman, reporting live from on 3 days of holiday with my family, where I will be by the time you hear this. John, meanwhile, is busy trying to see if he can perfect his formula for turning an iceberg into a bit of sea. Loves his science, the lad, and frankly, who can blame him? Also doing his show, trying to turn the Earth back into a sphere from its current shape, which is a series of question marks and exclamation marks. Before we get on to the main part of this week's show, please don't forget to book your tickets for my Satirist for Hire show. Links to the Edinburgh and London runs and details of the UK tour are now available at the website satiristforhire.com, which in common with my previous websites will probably not be winning any internet awards for most complex website. Please do email in any satirical commissions to satirise this at satiristforhire.com, and I will turn my satire machine on and point it in the direction of your target of ire. This week we have more from series 2 of Political Animal, recorded back in 2008, when America was in its quadrennial bout of election fever stroke democratic bubonic plague, and we devoted an entire episode of the show to the renowned nation stroke global touchstone of freedom stroke certifiable basket case. And here is what came out.
Yeehaw!
I beg your pardon?
You're welcome.
I'm John Oliver.
And I'm Andy Zoltzman. And for one night only, we are on the wrong side of the Atlantic for a special American edition of Political Animal.
Tonight's live stand-up gig features three of the finest comedians from this, the self-styled greatest country in the world. Although, according to official UN rankings, it's in fact only the 38th greatest.
Turns out they do mark you down for being politically, environmentally and economically naughty. Hard luck. To be precise, John and I are in the flood-stricken state of Iowa, often referred to as America's heartland.
Well, if that's true, this nation needs a triple bypass.
America's top cheerleaders are about to begin a national pep rally.
They will tour the country trying to distract people's attention from the harsh realities of reality, with their quintessentially American cocktail of hollowly upbeat chanting and slightly nauseating gender stereotypes.
These girls are the White House's latest and only strategy for lifting America's morale in the face of its current catalogue of problems.
This catalogue of problems. An economy that's melting down like a dead zebra's ice cream. The ongoing hoopla in Iraqi-ghanistan. Fuel prices smashing their own personal best on a daily basis. The aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Rising unemployment. The crisis in healthcare. Gun crime. The terror threat. Gay people finding happiness. Women being able to choose how to live their lives. How long is this thing?
Hey, girls.
Yes, Andy?
Give us a chant about the massive floods here at the moment. Billions of dollars worth of damage, thousands homeless. Spin the positive angle on that one.
4, 5, 6, 7, this flood will bring us close to heaven. It's God's will! Yay! It's God's will! Yay!
Right. I don't think that's going to make anyone's carpets any less wet, but your enthusiasm will at least make their carpets feel less wet.
Well, that's basically how religion works. And Iowa is literally nothing if not religious. We just saw a man in a makeshift ark.
Yeah, he had two cats, two dogs, two sausage baguettes, a donkey, and a very confused-looking woman in a donkey suit.
Hey, girls, make me feel better about the high-profile Taliban prisoners who broke out of jail in Afghanistan.
7, 8, 9, 10 means we can catch them again!
I suppose there's a twisted logic in that. It's like fishing. Once you've caught them, you should really just throw them back in.
Or at least charge your fish and give it a fair trial.
Otherwise, it's just cruel.
Yeah! USA! USA!
Come on, girls, that just sounds sarcastic.
I've done my quad.
Well, the pep rally is up and prancing, so let's pay our first visit to this week's live gig, which was recorded in the city that never sleeps and hardly ever snoozes, New York. Now for our look at the Democratic Party's no longer disputed 2008 champion, Barack Obama.
To get closer to the man behind the various competing myths, we've gone undercover in the Obama campaign team here at the Milwaukee Truckers for Democracy convention.
The 46-year-old professional senator is about to give the latest version of his speech in an attempt to win over the electorally crucial trucking community.
It will be basically the same as all of his other speeches, but with some added references to trucks thrown in. That's democracy, at its silly best.
I've gone undercover as the great man himself, Obama's campaign manager, David Plouffe.
And I've gone undercover as Barack Obama.
We talked our way in by claiming to be two of the Pointer Sisters, from whose 1973 funk classic hit, Yes We Can, Obama shamelessly plagiarised his Yes We Can slogan.
We then clonked the real Obama and Plouffe on the head with a porcelain Hillary Clinton, tied them up and locked them inside this cupboard.
We're just off stage now and waiting for clearance for Andy to begin Obama's speech.
John, what should I say to get Obama's message across to these truckers?
I don't know, mate.
Come on, John, you're my campaign manager. Your job is to give me the bread, my job is to feed the ducks, and I want to make them quack.
OK, you're definitely going to need to convince them that just 3 years' experience as a senator is enough to allow you access to the biggest and bangiest toy box in the world.
Or I could just argue that electing a fetus would be preferable to re-electing this administration.
Good idea. They love fetuses round here. Can't get enough of them. Otherwise, just smile, wave, and try not to sound too Muslim.
Well, I'm not Muslim. I, Barack Obama, am a committed Christian.
You are going to need a lot more than facts to convince people of that. And depending on which US news outlet these people swear allegiance to, they may well think that America is just one wrong vote away from putting Al-Qaeda in the White House.
Barack Obama, this is your two-second call!
Right, I'm on. Quick warm-up. Hope, change, hope, change, hope for change. Change our hopes. Hope, change, hope, change. Right, I'm ready. Let me at them.
Don't forget to mention the trucks!
Truckers!
Well, whilst Andy is busy confirming the truckers' prejudices...
So how are those trucks going
to... Let's get back to our live gig.
Our journey around America has taken us now to the geographical centre of the USA, tens of thousands of miles from civilization.
Here at the very heart of this award-winning prize cucumber of a nation is the driving force of the American economy, the Herbert Hoover Memorial Vortex of Debt.
America has basically been in debt ever since George Washington slapped one needlessly glitzy War of Independence on his credit card.
$9 trillion of national debt has disappeared into this whirlpool of future problems. The Bush administration's refusal to negotiate with terrorism, or the environment, or economic reality, or basic mathematics, or indeed the electorate, has made America's economic eczema especially itchy.
In fact, the entire debt-reliant economic system that is currently creaking like an arthritic door in a 1950s horror movie seems to be dependent on Alan Greenspan's magic budgerigar living up to his reputation and making everything okay.
Well, we've got the bird responsible here. Tell us, Horace, is the whole world economy built on sand?
Oh, sand, porridge and lies. That's a bit worrying.
What went wrong, Horace? We were relying on you to make sure that lending huge amounts of money to people who had no way of paying it back would be fine.
I'm only a little budgerigar.
Right, Horace, you're going to pay for this. Stick the rotisserie on, John.
Nice work, Andy. That budgie was the world's last realistic hope of avoiding catastrophic recession. Right, I'm going to sort out a new financial system for the world that isn't patently moronic. I owe that to myself.
That means that you're in debt to yourself, John.
Uh-oh.
No!
Now it's time to look at Barack Obama's opponent in November the 4th, one-night-only fiesta of democracy, John McCain. Republican, war hero, pensioner, war hero and man.
The Republican Party have very generously let us have a go in the cockpit of this 60-metre-high mechanical McCain, which is currently stomping around America to try to raise support for his campaign.
Right, let's give it a spin. Left, right, left, right. This is going pretty well. Wave to the crowd, Johnny. Whoops.
Hey, what does this button do?
That's the war hero emphasizer.
Oh, I'll give it a go. No, you klutz, that was the temper button.
Ah, they're very similar. Still, that was impressively fiery.
Sure was. Apparently McCain is the second stroppiest member of the Senate.
Quick, pacify them with the national anthem.
Oh, that works well.
And pull the policy announcement lever while they're listening.
I will drill offshore for oil. I will stay in Iraq for 100 years. I will support the temporary worker program. to combat illegal immigration.
Well, they did not like that, John.
Well, McCain is up against it, Andy. He's too conservative for some and not conservative enough for everyone else. And his best hope of winning, having Hillary Clinton as an opponent, has been cruelly taken from him.
Oh, cripes, it started raining.
How are the electrics on this thing?
Oh, he gets angry when he's wet. You wouldn't like him when he's angry.
I've lost control of him, Andy!
Oh, no, he's heading for the Empire State Building.
Oh, God, he's trying to hump it! Is there an override? This campaign does not need a sex scandal like this.
Right, we'd better get back to the live gig while we try to calm this mechanical architecture pest down.
You join Andy and me deep inside the basement of the White House.
Which is, of course, only white because the British burnt it down in 1814.
We did do that.
High five. We're about to receive a special advanced screening of the 22nd-long official history of President 43.
It's a tradition that on their final day of office, America's commanders-in-chief have their presidency flashed before their eyes.
The custom began, of course, with Abraham Lincoln, but the Americans have since developed a system which achieves the same amount of speedy reflection for their presidents without having to assassinate them.
Nixon was apparently particularly pleased when his presidency flashed before him through the medium of interpretative dance.
That wasn't an interpretative dance, John. That was the media jumping up and down outside his bedroom window, flicking V-signs at him.
President Bush will wave a mutually happy goodbye to his presidency on January the 20th, 2009, and will then be ceremonially dragged down here to watch the fruits of his, at best, occasional labours.
This project has been overseen by action movie legend John Woo, and promises to be really quite something.
This has been a big-budget presidency which deserves a blockbuster send-off. They're about to show us the latest version now. It's very much a work in progress, and if Bush decides to have a crack at Iran before he leaves office, the production team will have to run back to what's left of their edit room.
Shh, it's about to start, John. Oh, crumbs, I forgot my popcorn.
I take responsibility.
The United States and our allies constitute an axis of evil.
Trampling on what a duly constituted court and jury have found.
Rounding up people and indefinitely detained.
It does appear that he is.
Arming to threaten the peace of the world.
George Bush doesn't care about black people.
Katrina exposed serious problems at all levels of government.
Doesn't care about black people.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. States like these and their terrorist allies have prevailed.
I take responsibility.
Wow. That was depressing. I laughed harder at Vera Drake.
Did I miss anything?
You were hiding behind the sofa.
Good point.
The following week, we had left America and were back in the rest of the world in 2008. If you cannot remember what that was like, then listen to these sketches and you will be none the wiser.
Hello everyone and welcome back to Political Animal. Have you had a nice week? Good. I'm Andy Zaltzman.
And I'm John Oliver.
John and I have come up here to the Arctic to catch up with our old friend, global warming.
Which is making the Northern Hemisphere's leading polar ice cap crack up faster than a teenage soldier at the Somme.
And we're also here to fit in a little bit of skating. Hey, what's this, John? And that, my friend, is a textbook triple salco.
Ah, I'm not sure about that, Andy. Your landing was a bit messy.
You wouldn't know a triple axel if it pirouetted all over your nose. Slapshot.
Oh!
Got him!
A recent report from the US National Snow and Ice Data Center revealed that this summer will smash all records for ice loss.
Well done, humanity. That is a personal best.
They can't take that away from us.
Eat that, ancient Egypt. You couldn't melt your way out of an igloo.
Some scientists even say that the Arctic seas may be ice-free within the next 5 to 10 years. Great news for water skiers, bad news for polar bears.
But amazing news for polar bears who water ski.
That is evolution in action. I'm sure Darwin mentioned water skiing polar bears somewhere in his theory, and if he didn't, he should have.
Well, he did. It's in the chapter about paragliding alpacas. Great read, if you can be asked to wade through all the science to get there.
I certainly can't. I'm as sceptical about science as the rest of Britain.
Well, I blame science, John. If it wasn't for science, we wouldn't be in this mess. Or at the very least, we wouldn't know about it. And that, to me, is one and the same thing. Science, John, is basically witchcraft with a clipboard.
Well, you and Britain are very much burning the same page of your chemistry book there. A recent poll found that the majority of British people are still unconvinced that climate change is caused by humans, despite the fact that 2,500 of the UN's top science geeks have confirmed in writing that it almost certainly is. And they've shown they're working this time. Extra marks. But this is just part of a long and proud tradition of humanity ignoring looming catastrophe.
Yep. Nero fiddled while Rome burned.
Drake nipped down to his local bowling alley whilst the Armada armadied.
And little Neville Chamberlain jazzercised as Hitler checked the traffic reports for roads out of Germany.
Perhaps not our best Prime Minister, but what a six-pack. So, Andy and I are going to continue this hallowed custom by figure skating while the Arctic melts.
Maestro, please.
Andy, did you sew those sequins on yourself?
None of your business, John. Just keep your hands where I can see them.
Very well. On three, I'm going to throw you.
I'd rather you didn't.
Three. Whoops. Turns out the ice may be fractionally thinner than Olympic standard.
John, we'll definitely get marked down for that, you fool.
I'd better fish him out before the seals club him to death.
Christopher Dean never treated me like this.
While I'm attaching this pastrami bagel to the hook, let's pay our first visit to our live gig.
Oi, put some mustard on it!
Well, I successfully lured Andy out of the Arctic waters.
And we're now trying to find a bit of the environment to ask it what its shitting problem is.
According to a new US intelligence report, it's not just the ice caps that global warming has got its devastatingly melting eyes on. It's the whole of Western civilization.
Apparently, Big Johnny Climate Change is covertly plotting to do nothing less than destabilise the poor regions of the world by flooding, starving and droughting millions of people to death, thus exacerbating socio-economic tensions and thereby aggravating the terrorist threat to us completely innocent bystanders in the West. Now do you still want to give the environment your empty tin cans and newspapers? Think about it.
Some people say that the increasing environmental disasters battering our planet like a very cheap sausage are a sign of God punishing humanity for its sins.
Well, John, if this is how God punishes us, then looking at where he sends his biggest and nastiest catastrophes, the only conclusion we can possibly draw is that God is racist.
It's true. I mean, he clearly hates Africa, and Asia is pretty much bottom of his Christmas card list at the moment.
Of course, God's supporters would reply, well, he's from a different generation.
He doesn't really understand the issues.
You know, sometimes he doesn't even realise he's being racist.
But that doesn't make it okay, Andy.
No, but it does explain why he's so popular in certain parts of America. Anyway, the upshot of all this is that the environment has become a real pain in the arse.
Albeit one made worse by us jabbing our own buttocks with the rusty nail of excessive consumerism. Hey, Andy, I think I just spotted a bit of environment.
Where?
Just there.
What, that lake?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to teach this little prick a lesson.
Hold on, Andy.
No, John. I'm heartily sick of enduring minor inconveniences to my lifestyle for the environment and getting nothing back in return. I'm going to take matters into my own hands in the great British tradition of vigilante justice.
No. Let's at least start a dialogue with the lake.
Let go of my neck, John. Good boy. The time for negotiation is over. If the environment had wanted a peaceful settlement, it should have signed Kyoto. Give me my cudgel. Right.
Come here, you! Why do you hate the West so much, you ecological piece of shit?
Calm down, Andy!
Let me live my own life, lake face!
Oh, dear.
What have we ever done to you? Apart from place short-term fun over the long-term sustainability of human life. Help, John! He's fighting back!
It has a right to defend itself, Andy.
Quick, I need another bagel.
You're going to have to learn to swim if you want to survive this episode. Beating up a lake isn't going to solve anything.
Could you not have told me that 60 seconds ago?
Right, well, while I try and fish Andy out again, let's return to our live show.
Put a bloody gherkin on it this time.
Andy and I are at Silverstone. Let me tell you, if you're a Formula One car, it is the place to be seen this week.
We're here for the dress rehearsal for the British Grand Prix. We're just making sure the result is the one the sponsors have paid to see.
Sport has long provided a refuge for people like Andy and me, who like to cocoon themselves from real life.
Sport really is the ultimate anaesthetic, John. But the world is in such an aggressively vinegary pickle at the moment that even sport has been unable to resist passing comment on the political status quo.
Really? So what does Formula One, that carbon-naughty metaphor for capitalist excess, have to say about events around the world?
Well, look at Lewis Hamilton now, John. He's coming down the home straight, clearly and potently demonstrating the need for British and American governments to have a more flexible policy in Iraq.
Is he not just driving in a straight line?
Yes, John, and in doing so, Hamilton is strongly arguing that in some circumstances, you must be steadfast in holding your course.
Right.
Heading down to COPS now, and well, look at the 13-year-old speed ace here, John, turning his car, proving himself willing to reconsider the direction he's going due to changes in the prevailing circumstances of the circuit.
Interesting, because it looks like he just took a bend.
Hamilton saw potential catastrophe, but he took steps to avoid it. A powerful message to the US military there.
He just took the bend, Andy.
He did take a bend, John, yes, and that is exactly Hamilton's point. Withering stuff from the young man.
He's like an aerodynamic Noam Chomsky.
He's more than that, John. He's probably Britain's most politically outspoken driver since Nigel Mansell. Who can forget the Flying Moustache's famous blowout at Adelaide in 1986? Yes, it cost him the title, but he also raised awareness throughout Eastern Europe of how fragile the communist dictatorships were.
Oh, I get it. If as great a tyre as Nigel Mansell's back left could burst, then so could the Ceausescu regime in Romania.
Exactly. 3 years later, the Berlin Wall fell. Enough said. History will recall Nigel Mansell in the same breath as Nelson Mandela and Gandhi.
Whoa there, big stuff. While Andy and I hammer out the details of an official retraction for that last sentence, why don't you listen... Andy has brought me down to Wimbledon, where he claims the world of sport continues to address the world's most pressing issues.
Well, I'm right, John. The tennis players have been using their post-match press conferences to speak out to the world here at the All England Club.
And by all, you presumably mean middle.
Cork it, Trotsky. Let's hear what Roger Federer had to say yesterday to the French political news channel Était la Connuie.
Let all bow down before my phenomenal range of shots. But my Roger Federer cardigan offers a lesson to the USA for how it should deal with Iran. I could march onto center court wearing a massive crown, swinging an axe, and with a team of 12 eunuchs behind me, each carrying a Kalashnikov to represent my Grand Slam trophies. But I don't do that. No, no, no. I wear a Roger Federer cardigan, and in many ways that is more intimidating. Watch and learn, USA. Take the cardigan approach to international diplomacy, because I, Roger Federer, am better at tennis than you are at anything.
Wow. Federer is quite a thinker. Seems like tennis's gain was the UN's loss.
Well, he wasn't alone, though, John. Britain's Andy Murray pulled no punches after beating Belgian racket wielder Xavier Malisse last week.
Well, I think at the start of the match, he...
I am always pleased to beat any ex-boyfriend of my tennis hero, Jennifer Capriati. But my performance pales into insignificance in the context of the continuing scandal over political party funding.
You know, dictate some of the points myself.
When I lose my shit on the court and start swearing at whoever happens to be coaching me that day, it's because I've had enough of people playing the system like a wonky kazoo.
Early in the second.
It's got to bloody stop. And don't get me started on MP's expenses. Now leave me alone.
After the first two sets. But...
Strong words from Britain's greatest ever Scottish tennis player. And we're here on court 260, in the shadow of the magnificent new 20-foot-high statue of Arvind Palmer. The girls' singles final's about to begin.
Interestingly, political comment in tennis has now reached such epidemic proportions that the two inevitably Eastern European girls about to contest this final have names that are in themselves political statements. The Belarusian Ardesa Vaplentyerova and the Latvian sensation to many vested interests.
Bless you.
Time. First game. Miss Vaplentyerova to serve. Play.
Vaplentyerova serves, and it's a slow slice wide out to the Latvian's forehand. That's a good serve that highlights the European Union, how it should plan its future expansion carefully and with precision. Vested interest lunges for the return, but struggles to control it, showing the British government how difficult it is for the troops to do their job around the world when resources, like her, are so completely overstretched. Vaplentyerova replies, though, with... Oh, tennis shot! Clean winner! She hit that like the decisive action needed to resolve the Darfur crisis. And vested interest, well, like Aung San Suu Kyi, she had absolutely no chance to respond.
15 love.
Wonderful, incisive tennis, Andy.
Right, first serve.
Superb piece of compromise negotiation from the netcord there. Send it to the Middle East.
Andy and I have used our new Wimbledon connections to gatecrash Robert Mugabe's victory party here in Zimbabwe.
John, say what you like about Mugabe, unless you live here, of course, but the man is a winner. He has re-won his position of King of Zimbabwe for the 28th consecutive year, not only beating his opponent Morgan Tsvangirai, but also vanquishing the international community, his own electorate, and even basic mathematics.
You've got to admire his violent pluck. Well, either admire it or experience it.
We're here because not only is Mugabe celebrating winning the election he lost, he's also toasting another unlikely victory in this year's Wimbledon Ladies Singles Final, which takes place on Saturday. Mugabe has become the first Zimbabwean man to be Wimbledon Women's Champion since Suzanne Longlon in 1925, or to give her her real name, Mr. Umphumelelo Masakadze.
This really is an incredible party, Andy. Hundreds of Mugabe supporters have joined in a conga to celebrate.
That's not a conga, John. That's a mass exodus into South Africa.
My mistake. I did think it lacked the usual gusto.
It's an incredible party because the election was an incredible win. Everything seemed stacked against Mugabe. The hyperinflation that has broken all the abacuses at the World Bank and is reckoned now to be at around the 2 million percent mark.
I'd like to see Mervyn King try to quarter point interest rate tweak his way out of that one.
Then there's the 85% unemployment.
Then you've got your starvation, your poverty, your AIDS, all contributing heroically to a world record low 14th century throwback life expectancy.
And let's not forget about the years of devastating violence and intimidation he has rained upon his own country.
It seemed that no one in their right mind would vote for him.
And indeed they didn't. But Mugabe recognised that he still had, in a very real sense, a fighting chance. And spurred on by the lack of military disapproval from the international community, he went for it and got it.
Incredible stuff from the Harare hitman. Gordon Brown, watch and learn.
It's almost like he didn't really care about the prospect of having his honorary knighthood rescinded, or his country's cricket team banned from a tour of which no one would have taken the blindest bit of notice, or people saying lots of nasty things about him from a range of several thousand miles. He just seems immune to those kinds of tellings off, John.
That's because Robert Mugabe is a man who very much wears his style of leadership, neatly shaven, under his nose.
And that's all you're getting this week.
So, from the driving range at Royal Birkdale, where we're watching Ian Poulter getting ready to stick it to the trade unions with his six iron, it's goodbye from Political Animal.
Join us again next week, or we will hunt you down and kill you.
Andy, please stop wearing that What Would Mugabe Do bracelet.
And that was that. We do hope you're having a lovely summer. Just a quick reminder that I'll see you all in Edinburgh from the 13th to the 24th of August, then in London from the 22nd to the 27th of September, and around Britain from mid-September to early December. All details at satiristforhire.com. Commission submittable, once again, to satirise this at satiristforhire.com. Meanwhile, I think it's probably best that we all ignore what's happening in the world right now and reconvene in 1 week's time with more from our archives. From me, Andy Zaltzman, and everyone within the Bugle franchise, goodbye.
Mr. Tsvangirai has challenged the call on the election. The vote was called good. Call stands. Game, set, and match, Mr. Mugabe. 8 sets to love. 6 love. 12 love. 100 love.